Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
You've got to be able to fail, and you've got to be able to push the boundaries and go over the boundary and then go, oh no, that's a bit too much.
Hello and welcome back to another episode of Balancing Acts. In this conversation, I talk to poet, producer and co-founder of Baby Cow Productions, Henry Normal. Perfect. Hello, I'm Steve Whiteley and welcome to Balancing Acts, a series of conversations with an array of creatives. We talk about their journey, the struggles they faced whilst progressing their career, strategies they use to unlock their creativity, how they balance their career with their personal lives, what impact this has had on their mental health, and lots more. Having performed poetry at literature festivals and beyond around the UK, Henry Normal set up Baby Cow Productions in 1999 with Steve Coogan, where he exec produced and script edited many of the company's shows. Highlights include the feature film Philomena, Gavin and Stacey, Moon Boy, Marion and Jeff, Nighty Night, The Mighty Boosh, Red Dwarf, and of course, Alan Partridge. Since retiring in April 2016, Henry has written and performed 7 BBC Radio 4 shows: A Normal Family, A Normal Life, A Normal Love, A Normal Creativity, A Normal Nature, A Normal Universe, and A Normal Communication. These shows are a combination of comedy, poetry, and stories, and are available on BBC Sounds. In June 2017, Henry was honoured with a BAFTA for services to the TV industry, and he was recently given an honorary doctorate of letters by Nottingham Trent University and another by Nottingham University, and he even has a beer and bus named after him in Nottingham. So as you can imagine, this was a fascinating conversation. Henry explains his approach to creativity and describes how he's managed to find a sense of balance over the years between being a poet, writer, TV and film producer, and script editor, whilst he was also simultaneously running the very successful Baby Cow Productions. I could have listened to Henry talk for ages. He's just got so much insight on the creative process. It was just great hearing some of these stories about how he came together to collaborate with the likes of Steve Coogan, Carolina Hearn, and so many more talented comedians and writers. So this is a really great one. And remember, if you like this episode, if you're enjoying Balancing Acts, please do rate and review the podcast on Apple. It really goes a long way to getting the series discovered by new listeners and it helps go up the old Apple podcast chart. So all you have to do is go onto Apple, type in Balancing Acts, and then leave a lovely, glowingly positive review and do your nice good deed for the day. Oh, and also if you want to get my weekly newsletter, which includes latest podcast episodes and sometimes short stories and articles written by me and other fun stuff, then you can subscribe to my newsletter, which is on my website, stevewhiteley.co. And now, without further ado, over to Henry Normal. Perfect. So are you currently at your residence in Brighton?
No, we've moved from Brighton. We've moved
to
Fairlight, which is the other side of Hastings.
Okay. How are you finding that move?
We moved just before Christmas, so it was not the best time to move. I would never say to anybody, because you can't get workmen over Christmas. So if the heating doesn't work, which it didn't, you're on your own.
Okay, so was there lots of warm coats then during that period of time?
We laid in bed with very warm bodies but very cold heads.
Right. So, yeah, never fun.
A little like an Arctic roll, but sideways.
Yeah. You were in Brighton for many years.
Yes, for 24 years at least, because my son's 23 and we were certainly there when he was born. So
okay.
24, maybe sort of 25, I don't know.
And so was it nice now to start afresh somewhere new?
Well, yeah, new adventure, always good. Good for creativity if you change your surroundings, even if you move your chair from one side of the room to the other, you get a different point of view. I always remember somebody saying that creativity is about alignment, that you see things and match them together, and you can only see them from either that moment in time, as everything's moving, we're all in flux, or if you're in a certain position. So to change your position, it changes your chances of creativity.
That's a really interesting idea, an interesting view of creativity. Have you found that you've done that over your career in terms of your approach to creativity? Have you always tried new approaches depending on the project, or has it been a sort of very natural, fluid process?
I think so. The problem is that you're always competing against yourself.
Yeah.
And you don't want to become a tribute band to yourself, do you?
Right.
Do you know what I mean? You don't want to just be doing all your old hits and end up like Duran Duran or something, sort of, and everybody going, oh, they don't look like they used to.
Yeah.
You want to keep moving. I mean, you get an artist like, say, Nick Cave, and you look at the albums one after another, and there's a progression. So I think with any creativity, whether it's an episode of a series or whether it's a different series or whether it's something new or even a new medium, you want to try and find some way of exploring it. So to me, it's always things are a start of a new adventure and then you explore. The idea that you know what's coming up, oh, God, that's awful.
Yes.
That's the one good thing about death. You don't know
what's around the corner.
You don't know what's coming up. So who knows? It might be your most creative part.
Yeah. Let's hope so. So, and if you always found collaboration to be key in that, you know, because obviously you've written on a lot of your scripted projects and script edited, etc. Do you prefer to go away and write on your own, or have you enjoyed the collaboration process going back and forth?
I think they've both got their benefits. With the poetry, obviously, that's very much something that is just between me and the reader or the listener, if I'm talking.
Yeah.
So there's something very pure about that. And I started off as a poet and I started off as a writer. So that idea of the one-to-one conversation, and in some ways you're actually talking to yourself. So basically, it's a conversation with yourself, very often creativity, and then people earwig and eavesdrop into that.
Mm.
So that's quite interesting. Now, with collaboration, it dilutes it, but then in a way, it makes something that neither of you would have done on your own. So I wrote with Steve Coogan quite a bit and with Carolina Hearn, Craig Cash and Dave Gorman on the Mrs. Merton show and on the Royal Family. So I think on all those occasions, very often somebody would think of a joke and then somebody else would think of a joke that's just a little bit better.
Yeah.
And then you'd revise it and own it down. And what you'd get at the end was not necessarily the first thing that was discussed. And if you're doing a storyline, if you're on your own and doing a storyline, it can be quite linear. Whereas if you're arguing with somebody and they say, no, we could turn this way and we could turn that, then you often get a storyline that has more twists and turns. And you know, you're all the while you write a new line, you're making a new decision. Mm. And if there's two people making that decision, then you're likely to get different decisions.
So being open-minded plays a big part in terms of being open to suggestions from other people and not being too proud and, you know, stuck on your own.
No point in being proud if you're going to be with somebody. You've got to have a situation. And luckily, everybody that I've worked with, we've been in the situation where you can fail.
Yes.
Because you can't be funny 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. Nobody can be funny that. Nobody's that funny, even the best of the best.
Yeah.
So you've got to be able to fail, and you've got to be able to push the boundaries and go over the boundary and then go, oh, no, that's a bit too much. So there's no point in having any preconceptions of yourself. I think there's something very nice about sharing the creativity with someone. Obviously, once you make something like a film or a television, it's not just your co-writer that you're making it with. You're making it with the director. You're making it with the people who do costume, the people who do makeup, the people who do lighting. You know, everybody has an impact. I'll give you an example. When we first made the Royal Family, the first episode, we went in to see the set. And in our heads, it was the house that you see that you saw on the programme. But that wasn't how the set was to start off with. Instead of the door being straight to the outside, the door was at the back in a sort of like Frasier. The television show from America, with a little landing. As somebody had thought that was a good idea, that people could come in that way. But of course, that wouldn't be true to life. That wouldn't be true to what we were trying to write, a very true representation of working class life. Also, the house, if you can remember, the house on the Royal Family was a living room and a dining room knocked into one, so the wall was knocked out. So we went in and we said, well, where's the bit that juts out, where the wall used to be? You always leave a bit that juts out, and that wasn't there. So we didn't do any filming the first day. We asked for them to build that so that when you saw it, you'd think that was authentic. So you're in the hands of lots of creative people. I mean, a film like Philomena, you know, you're talking 200 creative people having an impact on that. Mm. So there's no point in being too precious. Obviously, if there's something that's needed that you need to catch, then, you know, it's great to catch it early. I saw the film Parole Officer, which I wrote with Steve. Yeah. I saw the masks that they were using for the robbery after they'd filmed it. If I'd have seen them before, I would have changed them.
Right.
In my mind's eye, when we wrote it, they were sort of grotesque in a sort of a Christian Bale Batman sort of way. Whereas when they actually filmed it, they're sort of play school masks. So I wasn't very happy. They were supposed to serve a particular joke because they were insects.
Right.
And they were supposed to serve the joke of her popping her head out and actually looking like an insect, which she didn't. She just looked like a primary school teacher.
So that's not an ideal situation once you see that on screen.
No, and so getting the creativity that you're hoping for through... even on radio, I mean, you know, you can't do radio on your own. You need a producer, so you need a good producer. Luckily, I've got probably the best, which is Carl Carl Cooper. And I totally know that when we record it and when we edit it, it's going to be the best of the best. But, you know, you really do need to have a good relationship. Even with just the one person, because you're very much in their hands. Even a book publisher, if you're publishing a book, you want to make sure that, you know, it doesn't look cheap at the end of the day.
Yeah.
And the cover is... I had one book cover that I don't like. I had a book with Blood Axe. Now, Blood Axe are a very well-known and distinguished book company. So I didn't have a lot of power because I was only in my late 20s at the time. And they said they wanted this cover. And so I went along with it. and I ate it. And it's the worst cover. I've had about 30 books out, and it's the only one that I ate. And right. It's with the biggest publisher.
I see.
Sometimes it's about the power structure.
Yeah.
So I'd definitely try to retain some degree of power on your own creativity if you can. That's what's beautiful about poetry. If I write and read a poem, I have total control.
Yeah.
If you make a film, you've got partial control.
How was that transition for you going back to starting off obviously as a performer and poet and then setting up Baby Cow in 1999? Was that a difficult transition to go from being just, I guess, purely creative and solely working on your own material to then stepping into the role, which is, I guess, partly business, but obviously also very creative, and then sharing that creativity and the project with others? Was that a challenging transition?
Well, it was over a long period of time, and it was incremental. It seemed like a lot of steps. So if I take you back, I was an insurance broker when I was 20.
Okay.
So I know how an office works.
Yes.
And I know how you have to control the expenditure. So when I finally got to running Baby Cow, the training I had as an insurance broker, which you might think is a million miles from making comedy, was actually useful in running the business. When I got into writing and performing, it was very much myself, and all I had to worry about was making people laugh.
Mm.
And getting booked and paying the rent. For that lasted a good 10 years of me trying to, get noticed, learn my craft, because it's no good getting noticed if you're not actually any good when you're noticed. There's a great sense of community I find amongst creative people. Started off in Nottingham, went to Chesterfield, where I met lots of really creative people, lots of different art forms, which is great because it makes you think in different ways. You know, if you're talking to a sculptor and you're talking to a visual artist, it makes you think a little bit because we're all dealing with images. So they're just dealing with images in a different way. So that was a great grounding. And then I went to Manchester and I met Steve Coogan. He was only 19 when I met him.
Wow.
And I was 29, so I was 10 years older than him. Caroline Hearn, but lots of people like Linda Smith coming over from Sheffield, and Frank Skinner coming up from Birmingham. There was a sort of a northern, I won't say circuit, because they weren't really comedy clubs, but there was a good deal of people that were trying to start off. Dave Gorman was very young at the time. John Thompson, all trying to start off. And because we all knew each other and because we all was on at the gigs, then you'd often, drive in a car together to a gig.
Yeah.
And if you had a bit of a project, like if I had a radio show or something, I'd get them on my radio show. So they're just repeating a show I did called in 28 years ago called Encyclopedia Poetica. And if you look at the guests on it, you've got Lem Sisse, who's now a big... international poet,
yeah.
Who was about 19 at the time, and Attila the stockbroker, who I think has always been about 300 years old. So it was very much that sense of community and everybody getting everybody else to work on their shows. I went up to Edinburgh, which is where you were told to go, because none of the TV would basically come to Manchester, or if you were doing a gig in Wigan, nobody was going to come to Wigan to see you. So you had to go to Edinburgh.
Mm.
So I did a show with Atty Aridge, who was a good friend of mine, who you probably know from Red Dwarf. It was the same year Steve went up, and Frank and lots of other people went up for the first year. And I was offered a television show. So strangely enough, I was offered a television show before the rest of them in our little community. And so I got everybody on my show. So I asked for Frank to be on the show. It's called Packet of Three. And I got Steve on as doing his first national character comedy. Okay. And I got everybody, you know, Dave Gorman was on there doing some poetry, strangely enough. And we did a series of that. And then Caroline was given the Mrs. Merton show. And so she asked if I would come and write the Mrs. Merton show. So that great sense of community with getting everybody together, and Dave Gorman and Craig Cash both wrote on that series as well. And when Steve got given a show, he asked me to write on that. So I was writing both for Caroline and for Steve at the same time. So I'd work weekends and night, dinner times, first thing in the morning. I was the only one with a computer.
Okay.
Which was an old Amstrad at the time, which when it printed out made the, like, it was like being in World War II. So I was a little bit older than everybody else. So I was sort of the grown up, and I did all the script editing and tidying up and presenting. But certainly Caroline and Craig themselves were the drivers of a lot of the creativity, because, you know, they'd got to a certain level, and they're both brilliant comics.
It sounds like you're already doing that kind of role in terms of the producing role, but were you at this point the equivalent of the designated driver pitching projects then to broadcasters that you were collaborating on?
No, I wouldn't say that. No, in terms of the processing of the script, I was, yes, the designated driver, the responsible adult.
Yes.
The creativity was very much, you know, everybody had a pitch in, and certainly working for Caroline and Steve at the time, you know, they were the people behind themselves, if you like. People always wonder who the brains is. Well, they were the brains. So, you know, we were just in on the adventure. And I like to think sometimes in my more romantic moments that I was like the consigliere to Steve's godfather. There's a lovely atmosphere at the time, but I'd say working for both of them, I was a little bit stretched. And so when I'd finished the Royal Family, we made Mrs. Merton and Malcolm series. And Steve asked me if I'd write a film with him, which was The Parole Officer. And so I had to choose between doing the second series of The Royal Family or doing a film. And of course, I've always wanted to write a film. The other thing, as we're coming on to work balance, work and family balance, I had a child on the way. In Brighton, and Steve had a kid, a young daughter in Brighton. So the idea of working in Brighton rather than commuting to London or Manchester seemed a good choice. Mm. So rather than choose to write the second series of The Royal Family, I chose to write the film with Steve. And whilst we were writing that, Steve said, well, it's ridiculous as commuting to London or Manchester. Why don't we set up a company in Brighton? So that's when we set up Baby Cow, and the offices were originally in Brighton. So that progression, as you're talking about, from being a solo performer, came over a period of having my own show, working on Steve and Caroline's shows, and then getting to the stage where we'd done enough that people would trust us to actually get more involved and actually make programmes ourselves. Now, people are giving you millions of pounds to make television programmes. So it's not the sort of thing you might do to a 16-year-old. So you have to have a certain degree of experience in the business for somebody to trust you with, a show can cost £3 million. So somebody to trust you with that sort of money. So the progression was steady. The first program we made was Human Remains with Julia Davis.
Yeah, and, brilliant show.
And Rob Brydon.
Yeah.
And it won RTS awards. So we must have done all right.
it sounds like then it was sort of a natural progression for you to get to the point where you opened Baby Cow, as opposed to it being something that was an ambition from early off. You know, some people say, right, my end goal is to set up a production company and be my own boss. Whereas you kind of, it seemed to happen in a very sort of happy, accidental manner.
Yeah, I'm not sure anybody as a kid thinks I'm going to run a business. That would be a very strange kid. I got into the business because of, I would say, three or four people. Okay. Initially, Jack Benny. I saw Jack Benny on the Dean Martin show. Yeah. And he was in a tuxedo. And I was in a council estate, and my mum had died. She died when I was 11 in a car accident. So we didn't have much money, five kids and a dad that worked at Raleigh. And he came in this tuxedo, and Dean Martin was on the phone, and they nodded to each other. And Jack Benny got down on the floor, didn't sit on a sofa, and started playing dice on his own. And I'd never seen a grown-up do this. This was grown-ups around where I was. They went to work, they came home, they watched the telly and they did the pools. Yeah. That was it, you know, and hoped that something would happen. So the playfulness of that, I thought, that's the world I want to be in.
Yeah, right.
So if you'd have asked me around that time, what do I want to be? I want to be Jack Benny.
Yeah,
here's the thing. And in my head, when I was playing Glossop or King's Lynn or Aberdeen, I was Jack Benny. You wouldn't know this, but in my head, that's the world that I wanted to play. So again, the sort of the New York Jewish comedy of the 30s and 40s was very much a family thing, you know. I don't know whether you know that Jack Benny was asked to be one of the Marx Brothers, even though he wasn't.
I didn't know that.
A brother,
okay.
Because there was very much a sense of community there amongst the comics. So I loved that, and I was drawn to that as well.
Yeah.
So certainly, when I got involved in performing, to me, part of the attraction was you know, the sort of the community of other artists. And the other people that were very much involved in my early thoughts were Spike Milligan. Doing a radio show on, I've recorded it on Tuesday, Great Lives for BBC Radio 4. And I chose Spike Milligan as the person to do the show about. And so, again, in my head, if I was as much of a genius as he is, which I'm not, the idea of being something like Spike Milligan. Now, he worked in all sorts of different medium. So he did brilliant books, he did poems, he did radio shows, and he did television shows. Did a few films, not any big films, but he did some small films. And the other person would be Roger McGough, who was a poet and still is a poet. As you know, sort of consistently over the years, invented and explored the idea of accessible poetry.
When you reached the point of deciding to retire, did you have it in your mind that you were going to focus purely on your poetry? Was that the reason why you decided to retire, because you wanted to get back to performing sort of full time?
Well, I'd made over 450 television programmes, and over a dozen films. So it did strike me that if I made 451, nobody'd know the difference.
Right. Yeah.
So I must have peaked at some point, getting four Oscar nominations for Philomena was probably the highlight, and seems to be at the moment the highlight of Baby Cow. So it seemed like a good time. But of course, on the home front, I have an autistic child.
Yes.
Johnny is 23 now. His mum, Angela, has worked hard over the years to bring out the best in him. And partly I wanted to spend more time at home, both with my wife, who's very beautiful, and my son. I love, although he is beautiful as well, I should mention.
Yeah.
And my own, which I paid for and didn't get to see.
Right.
It's very strange. Nobody ever says at the end of the life, I wish I'd spent more time at work.
Yeah.
So it did strike me that that would be a good time. And I managed to work hard enough managed to build the company up enough that I could afford to, which is the other thing.
Yeah.
A lot of people would like to retire, but, you know, you've got to make sure it's practical.
Sure. Do you miss it at all?
I miss the people because I had some great friends that I could see every day. And occasionally I speak to people and occasionally people pop round or we meet up. But to actually see a group of people every day and have a common purpose.
Yeah.
It's a bit like being in the trenches, I would imagine.
Yeah.
There's some great camaraderie that I miss.
Yeah.
But the upside is that I get to spend a bit more time on the beach, even if it's cold, which it is at the minute. Mm. So we're only 5 minutes from pet level, which is where they filmed the video for Ashes to Ashes. And I think the bulldozer that was behind him is still there. So you can go and do the video yourself.
I think I might have to do that. Are you currently touring at the moment? Because I knew you had a tour lined up for this
year.
Well,
yes, I did. I was supposed to be touring originally, just as COVID hit. That was great comic timing.
Yeah.
And they put it off, and I actually took a chance last autumn and did 16 dates.
Okay.
And then I've got 22 dates starting on the 10th of February in Sudbury.
Okay.
Obviously, it's good to start in Sudbury.
Yeah.
22 days. Now, I'm hoping that COVID and Omicron is the latest one. You know, the next one's Pi, don't you?
Yes. Yeah, I've got that noted down.
So, you know, whatever Pi comes out like.
Yeah.
I do like a Pi, but probably not that one.
Not that one, no.
So you know, I'm open to do those, and it's basically me doing some poems. I pick a theme for each show. So I do a radio show every 8 months, and the last one was about aging, called Normal Aging, make it nice and simple. And the next one's about history and how history reflects on our everyday lives, because people don't tend to think it does. But if you think about it, we define ourselves by history, and how we define ourselves reflects how we act. So history does enter into your decision making every day.
Yeah, very much so. How do you think that's informed how we've been acting over the last couple of years in terms of this pandemic?
Well, we've got an history in this country and a perceived history of revolt, which is not bad. And we're healthy individualists within the group. If you think of places like China, which have a different history, the idea of individual thought of self is less to the fore. It's one of the reasons, I think, why, despite our education system, we have so many inventors, because people are able to think differently, and we have a very neurodiverse population. But also it causes problems. So, yes, I think we define ourselves as a nation of free individual thinkers. And therefore, you have to allow for that thought process when it comes to everybody doing the right thing.
Yeah, and everyone, I guess, having the freedom to make their own decisions and what they feel is the right approach and which way to act.
You and I might agree or disagree on the logic of some of the things like wearing masks and the logic of getting a jab, and however obvious we might think it is, somebody might have a different point of view.
Yeah.
Because as I say, you know, if we all thought the same, that would be very strange, given our history.
Yes, indeed. So you said you've done sort of 16 dates last year you were performing live. How was that process to go back on the road? Was it something you enjoyed? Do you like being on the road and being in amongst it and performing? Obviously, you enjoy performing, but just that feeling of just performing at different dates subsequently.
Do you know, I love performing. I do like people and I like interaction with people, and it's a strange thing. Like most poets, I like my solitude, but then this question you're talking about balance. So I like periods when it's just me on a beach with a paper and pencil, and then I like other periods where I'm surrounded by people and we're having a laugh. It's quite a nice sort of controlled way of expressing your creativity, being on stage as a solo act. So I go onto the stage and do probably about 50 minutes and then a break and then another 50 minutes. It's during that period, I don't think about the past and I don't think about the future. What I think about is the present.
Yes.
And it mirrors to me the joy I had when I was a kid and I'd play football.
Right.
And whilst you're playing football, you're essentially dancing.
Yeah.
You're using your body and you're enjoying the use of your body. And I think there's something similar in that way that you're connected with the present when you're performing.
Yes, very much so. Just getting into that zone, being there. I did stand up for 3 years and I haven't performed since the start of the pandemic. But there's the odd moment, if I'd look, I always seem to focus on the angry face in the audience, you know, with their arms crossed.
Yes.
I couldn't get away from that. And then sort of that would just take me out of it. And I could feel myself getting angry in response, but then just trying to have to stay present.
You know, you've got to think the best of people. I did a show in Nottingham, which is where I'm from. And I had 200 people. It was place was full. And I performed. And I performed for about 50 minutes. And I got to the one poem that is, in my opinion, the best poem in the show.
Okay.
And it's about my son, and it's a very serious poem. And I got about four or five lines into it, and it's about 30 lines long.
Yeah.
And somebody got up and walked out. And it was silent.
Right.
Because it's a serious poem. And I've got 199 people looking at me, and one person walking down some steps, walking along the front and walking out the door. Now, so I've done about 50 minutes. So I'd hope that by 50 minutes that you like me, because if you're not, you've had a rough 50 minutes. So I'm thinking, I'm sure you can allow me a minute to do this one poem. And so that plagued me over the half time break. I'm thinking, oh my God, you know, is it the particular poem? Are they taking objection to it? Because my son's autistic, is there something about other autistic, or have they got a kid that's autistic? Or, you know, so I'm thinking about that. And then the second half, I carried on but all the while in the back of my mind, I'm thinking, this, you know, everybody's laughing and we're having a good time everything seems to be working and get to the end and everybody's happy and I go out and I still, you know, 2 weeks later, my sister who was at the gig says to me, that lad who walked out, he was sat in front of me. He'd been holding his bladder for the last 10 minutes. And his girlfriend was telling him not to go and he finally went out. I said, why didn't you tell me that at half time?
Yeah.
And then I've been worrying for 2 weeks.
Yeah.
So there you go. You know.
We can tell ourselves all kinds of stories when we're on stage about the behavior of different audience members. Perfect. Hello, sorry to interrupt in the middle of this insightful conversation, which I'm enjoying, I'm sure, just as much as you are. But I need to give you guys a little reminder. If you like this conversation, this episode, if you like balancing acts in general, then please do subscribe to us, rate and review us, because it makes the world of difference. And the more reviews we get, the more rates we get, the more people can discover the podcast and we can make it go viral, whatever that means. Okay, back to the chat.
Yeah, and but it's sometimes it's nothing to do with you. I was on. I did a gig with a Sheffield band called Digby's Drill. I'm going back 30 years now, okay. And they're a really heavy sort of punky band with. I think they were one of the first people to use computer reels in the sound, and a great band. And I used to go on and do some jokes beforehand, and. There was a bloke kept shouting. And this was at Brighton, before I'd moved to Brighton, at the Zap Club. Okay. And it's a big, long club. And so you can't see past the first couple of rows and people are stood up and it's dark. I was just shouting. I'm thinking, you're not even giving me a chance. You know, I'm down here. I'm in front of a punk gig. My name's Henry Normal. I'm obviously not. That aggressive or that, you know, I'm trying to entertain. Now, I did me a set, it was about 20 minutes, and I went back, and this bloke was still shouting, and I got past all the people, and I looked on the floor, and there was a semi-naked bloke on the floor, obviously out of his head, shouting, and I could have been his mum on the stage. It wouldn't have mattered to him. So it was nothing to do with me.
Whatsoever.
And so, in a way, when you're performing, you've got to have that sort of understanding that if you're next to the toilet door or the mic doesn't work or wherever, it doesn't reflect on you as a comedian.
Yeah,
you just have to do the best you can.
Yeah, yeah.
I always remember seeing Jeremy Hardy on stage once, and halfway through his performance, a cat walked across the stage. And of course, everybody's attention went to the cat.
Yeah.
What he was talking about, nobody could remember.
Right.
And he knelt down, he picked the cat up and he gave it a stroke. And he said, I'm supposed to be doing a monologue, not a catalogue. which was a brilliant little ad lib. But, he obviously sussed the idea that you just got to go with it. It's not, the things happen in the world.
Yeah, that's a very good approach to take. I mean, one that probably that's what you develop over time, having done as many shows and performed as much as you have. In terms of your radio series, I know you combine comedy and music and your poems. How was that writing process for you? Did you know before you even started developing these shows that that's what you wanted to do? You wanted it to be an amalgamation of all these various things? And if so, how was the writing process for you for that?
Yes, I did know before I started. What I wanted to do was, I've always thought that comedy works best when it informs and it adds seasoning to something. Comedy on its own is a bit like sugar, and you wouldn't eat sugar on its own. But if you're telling a story like we did with Steve's shows, then you can tell a story. It might be a love story, it might be a story about companionship, it might be a story about getting old, and you put comedy into it, then it makes the journey and it makes the story better. And in my radio shows, I wanted to have a theme for each one, and to explore the theme and talk about the theme and use the comedy as a way of saying, all right, there's going to be some serious bits in here, but it's still going to be entertaining. But for me, in a way, part of the joy of it is that the comedy helps package the serious bits.
Yes.
And if I didn't know serious bits in the show, it wouldn't be the same for me. It wouldn't be worth my while doing them.
Was it quite a cathartic experience in terms of, within your shows, you're talking about the experience of having an autistic son and the challenges that have gone with that? Did you find it quite therapeutic in that respect? Have you found that over
Yes, but
of time?
It's not just about my son, about anything. I said the last one was about aging, and I'm 65 now.
Yeah.
I'd like to say I'm a pensioner, but the government's bamboozled me. by moving it back.
Yeah.
So I'm chasing my pension. And the all the things that you don't think about when you're a young man and are obvious now when you get to 65 intrigue me. Yeah. And intrigue me that I could talk to myself as a 20-year-old and say, you're not bothered about these things now, but this is what happens.
Yeah.
And so to actually be able to speak to somebody through the radio and say, these are the things that's coming up and it is strategies to deal with them and ways. And I think all the shows that I've done, I work on that basis of that I'm informing a younger version of myself.
Okay.
And it started off, the first one was about my son is called A Normal Family.
Yeah.
And again, what I was trying to do was having had 15 years of having an autistic child, say to somebody who's just found out that they've got an autistic child, these might be some of the things that crop up over the next 15 years, you know, it is a thought process for you.
Did you get much feedback from parents of autistic children or the autistic community in terms of
Well, my wife Angela and I wrote a book based on our experiences, and it became a Amazon bestseller. I should qualify that it's an Amazon bestseller in the conditions section.
Okay.
I think we got some like 75 star reviews of it. Brilliant. And a lot of great individual people have come on to me because I'm on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram and said how much it's helped them deal with their situation. And do you know, you can have an award, and I've got a few awards and they're great, sat there and they look very nice. But when another human being says to you that something's helped them, it's better. I've had some of my poems read out at funerals, and the idea that somebody would mark their life with some of your words is a huge compliment.
Mm.
So it's trying to get past the obvious sort of benefits of being in the communication business to the more human benefits.
Yeah, that's a really nice way of putting it. I guess when you're starting off, you think back to when you're starting off writing poems, et cetera, and where it's led you in terms of your life, you can't predict something like that and all these different impacts it has in various facets.
Well, I don't think anybody starts off writing poems thinking I'm going to make a lot of money. and I don't think anybody does.
Yeah.
You start off, and I'm sure this is probably the same with politics and things like that. You start off because you have a yearning. You have something in you that says, I want to communicate, even if only to myself. I want to communicate something. There's something I need to communicate.
Yeah.
What I've found with every creative person that I've ever met is that they are disconnected with the world and were disconnected either as children or in their early teens or adulthood. And that idea of being in the moment, that idea of being at the center and not being self-aware goes. And you look at the world as if to say, how do I fit into this?
Mm.
And then from then onwards, everything's like a jigsaw puzzle of trying to understand how you fit into it. And I think a lot of creativity is down to that. And I think I've worked with lots of people who more or less write the same story because they're exploring the same issue again and again. I can understand why that's the case, because if something doesn't seem right to you and you're trying to understand it, then you explore it from one way and explore it from another way.
Mm. Yeah, that's really interesting. Again, it goes back to what I was saying in terms of it becomes quite therapeutic as a process, you know, figuring things out.
I think it does, but funnily enough, my first reaction to that is that sounds a little demeaning to the whole process. When in actual fact, I think every artist, Picasso, Michelangelo, you could probably say the same for them. And it shouldn't be demeaning. It should actually be, yes, that's part of the raison d'etre, but it doesn't undermine that it's the greatest art in the world.
Yes. So I wanted to ask you a couple more questions before we wrap up, Henry. What have you done outside of work? Have you had a few go-tos to relax and unwind and take your mind off work, even though for you it seems like your work is your play to a certain degree?
The poetry is, whereas the television is a different headspace, and however much I enjoy it, I wouldn't say it was relaxing. It's a bit like playing football. You can play football and enjoy it, but it takes an effort. I like nature. That sounds a bit bland, doesn't it? But particularly beaches. So I've lived by the sea now for over 30 years. So I've been brought up in Nottingham. You were probably the furthest distance from any sea in this country. So I find walking and sitting by the sea and in nature and exploring bits of nature, even Dungeness, where I went the other day, which is not the prettiest place, I find that very diverting. And again, it gives you that thing of you're seeing the world from a different angle. And there's a different language to bits of nature. So I've moved from Brighton to Fairlight. There's a whole new. I was down walking along a dike the other day, which is called Dim Something Sewer, which sounds awful, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does.
But it's beautiful. Right. You know, rushes and everything, and you've got all this like where we are in the Pep level, which is about 5 minutes away. They've got sunken forests, so under the sea there's beach and hoke and there's a 17th century boat there that you can see the remains of, and so all this new thought process that I hadn't had before. You start thinking about the connotations of an undersea forest.
Yeah.
And I think there was they found a dinosaur footprint there as well, which is still there, obviously. It's not gone. And so to me, it's I'm thinking, but I've never, that's not been immediate to me. I've known of these things. I've known, somewhere there are these things.
Yeah.
But they weren't near enough to me to become in my alignment. And now, if I go down to the beach, which I'll do this afternoon, it's in front of me. So as regards my thought process, it becomes part of my thought process.
Yeah. Yeah, I can relate that from the perspective of surfing. I always remember to look up and look at the landscape facing me. I mean, I should be facing the waves, but
No. But you surf in different places. So if you surfed in Portugal, you would have a different feel.
Exactly.
So if you wrote about surfing in Portugal as opposed to surfing off Bristol, there's different, even though it's basically you're on the sea, it's going to feel very different.
And it feels like a privileged point of view, because it's not one that everyone gets to see, because I'm out there just sitting on that surfboard. So I think I can understand it from that periphery, from my perspective.
There's something quite nice about being on the edge of the land.
Yes.
Again, it's a bit like, where Glastonbury, whenever he's jumping up and down.
Yeah.
There's no writers jumping up and down. They're all on the side looking at people. I think there's something quite nice about being on the side of Britain, looking back. It sort of gives you a perspective.
Definitely. Yeah. And that outsider's perspective is definitely part of being a writer. I mean, just the people watching. I mean, it's one of my favorite things to do. It's one of my favorite pastimes, just sitting in a cafe, just observing people.
Yes.
Spying, being a nosy bugger. Henry, are there any books that stand out to you that have had a major impact on or inspired you in some way?
Yes. Well, I mentioned Spy Milligan earlier. The first poetry book I ever bought, because I thought it was a comedy book and it turned out to be a poetry book, was Spike Milligan's Small Dreams of a Scorpion.
Okay.
And when I read it, some of the poems made me cry. And I thought, a man that could be so funny, because he would make me cry laughing. I'd be on a bus reading, you know, A Dustbin Full of Milligan or something. Yeah. And I would be in tears and my stomach would hurt from laughing. And there he was making me cry because of, you know, words on a bit of paper.
Yeah.
That were serious. So that gave me that yearning to want to have both, to want to be able to move people and make people laugh. Yeah. And there's something about going from one to the other that makes both powerful.
Mm.
And that you're not in that midsection, you're making a commitment. And something about laughing which gives you over to the person that's making you laugh. So that once you've given over to them, then they say something serious, it cuts deeper.
Yeah. Yeah, very much so. I mean,
you're on their side.
Yeah, and it takes a certain level of bravery to be that sincere and
to be open. Yeah, to be open. I mean, it comes back to what we were saying at the beginning about being open and accessible to people. And that's not just to collaborators, but to everybody that's going to see or witness your work.
Yeah,
More recently, Max Porter's book, "Grief Is a Thing with Feathers," I thought was a brilliant long poem about a man who's lost his wife and he's got kids to look after. I thought that was really. I don't usually like long poems. I sort of get a bit bored halfway through, but I thought that was brilliant.
I can relate. Okay. All right. Great. I will check that out. There was one question I wanted to ask you earlier, and the only reason I'm bringing it up is because you're talking about Spike Milligan and having this ability to go from being, you know, funny to serious and talking about serious subject matters. Was there a sort of a challenging transition from writing and doing the performance side of things, putting on your funny brain, to then handling more of the business side of the industry? Because did you find you had to transition in terms of like different sides of your personality, or did they sort of just, I don't know, was it more of a fluid thing and you didn't really think about it so much?
Well, you could say they're both problem solving.
Yes.
If you think about it. I mean, when writing, we get to a situation where you think of an overall plot.
Yeah.
And then each scene you've got to get from A to B, in a funny way, and you've got to get your character to do something. So you're sort of problem solving by saying, how can we do that?
Mm.
It's a similar sort of brain, you know, when you're running a business. You've got to get to the end of the year without going bust.
Yeah.
And hopefully make something that's worth making. Steve and I had one rule in that we would only make things that we would watch ourselves. There's no way we'd make something and say, yeah, we don't like it, but that's for others. We had to like it to be able to make it. Because you can't make it better if you don't like it in the first place.
Yeah.
I don't know how you would judge to make it better. So I would say every show that we made, you know, was one I liked, and a lot of them that I love.
Is there, I mean, I don't know if this is an unfair question. Did you have a favourite standout show that you made?
Well, my wife's film, Snowcake, with Sigourney Weaver and Alan Rickman, because it's essentially about my son. Is a standout. It opened the Berlin Film Festival, and I got to stand next to Sigourney Weaver and light a cigarette with one of them box matches thing. So from a lad from a council estate being stood in Berlin,
that's pretty good going,
lighting Sigourney Weaver's cigarette, it was like I was in the movies.
Yeah,
wow. So that was rather beautiful, and she is you know, sort of world class, you know, sort of film royalty, as was Alan Rickman, sadly now departed.
Yeah.
Beyond my wife's, I would say I loved working with Julia Davis, and all her shows. She put so much work into them, and she. The vision for comedy and pushing the boundaries was so exciting to work on. It was like a roller coaster ride, right. And trying to get a vision actually onto the screen intact without diluting it was a real challenge, and I love that, and I love the shows that we made together.
Yeah, they all had a sort of a slightly dark tone to them, which just worked for her so well.
Well, yes, I don't think she's going to do anything light and frothy.
No,
but I say the mixture of comedy and seriousness.
Yeah, brilliant.
I think there were in a way visual poems that she was doing with her style and vocabulary and the themes that she wanted to explore. But I think she did them so passionately with all her senses
that
what we actually ended up with were works of art.
Yeah, that's a great way of putting it. You've come across so many different types of talent, and you've seen those that have gone to maybe the next stage and been what is deemed to be successful, as opposed to others who might not have necessarily progressed to that next level.
Yeah.
From your point of view, is there something that specifically to attribute to a certain personality type that does succeed and ends up making the show or ends up being a successful stand-up as opposed to somebody who might not necessarily progress to that next level? Do you think a lot of it is just deemed down to luck?
that's a very interesting. Angela and I were talking the other day about luck by design.
Okay.
Which is an interesting concept, isn't it? I think you can help luck and help opportunities and help make the most of those opportunities. Of the people I've worked with, and I've worked with some very, very funny people that never made it in television, but were... If Steve and myself and Frank Skinner and all the people that made it in television, if they went on after this person, they would struggle because this person's so funny.
Wow.
I'm not going to... I will name a few names there. So Bob Dillinger in Manchester was one of those people, and Kev Cisse. No relation to Lem Cisse, was one of those people that was so funny. But and I don't know why they didn't make it in television. There might be, reasons that I don't know of. But I do know of the people that that did make it, that stamina is very much to the core. You've got to be able to go to Aberdeen for 30 quid.
Right,
and play to 13 people and do your best and come back and then do it again tomorrow. And know that when you're doing that, that's part of the process that will get you to doing the stadium gig or doing the television series or doing the Hollywood film, that you've got to do that and you've got to keep doing that. So stamina and perseverance. Obviously some degree of originality and you don't necessarily have to be that original, but it has to have a sense of start with. You have to have a sense of yourself there. I think when we all start off, we all look to the previous generations, and we're probably, like me, I might be wanting to be a little bit Jack Benny. Never was, but wanting to be a little bit Spike Milligan. And then you find what works for you, what you're capable of. If you know fairly early on what it is that you do well, that can help. Take Steve. So Steve did funny voices and he could have been the next Mike Yarwood, but he hated the idea of being the next Mike Yarwood. He wanted to be the next Peter Sellers. So he set out his stall and he said, no, I'm not going to do, because he did all loads of voices for Spit and Image, and he says, I'm going to do characters. And so he started doing Paul Carf and Alan Partridge and all these things. And then he's got into Hollywood films. But that's because he made that decision that this is the way I want to go. And so he knew in his mind what he did and what he wanted to do. And, you know, it could have earned a lot of money being a Mike Yarwood. But, you know, it wouldn't have been as happy.
Yeah, so having a plan, being focused and carrying that out and being fully committed.
Yeah, having a sort of a confidence in yourself, I'm sure, helps. Although it might surprise you how unconfident a lot of confident people are behind the scenes.
Yeah.
A lot of people are essentially shy, and you know, part of the performance thing is to well, it won't, because you're a performer, is about putting on another persona. One of the reasons I called myself Henry Normal is that my real name, Peter Carroll, he'd not done anything particularly brilliant up to that point in time. I was hoping Henry Normal might surpass him,
right?
And so you put on this uniform, if you like, this costume, this persona, and it allows you a fresh start, and it allows you to be in a way that you might not be once you take off the name and the uniform and you carry on with the rest of your life.
Yeah, you're almost sort of unshackled by the burdens of your past or who you deem yourself to be. You can be someone
completely new. Henry Normal has never been turned down by beautiful women.
But
Peter Carroll has many times.
All right, okay, I might have to think about this in more detail.
But there is, I'm sure if you talk to anybody that's changed the name or anybody that's whose performance on stage, I mean, you think of everybody from Alice Cooper, was very different on stage to off stage, and Meatloaf, who's just died. I mean, when he got on the stage, I mean, he was a whirlwind.
Yeah.
But he made that choice. He said, "I'm going to be a whirlwind on stage," and he did that. And obviously, you know, Meatloaf. He wasn't born Meatloaf, was he? Mum didn't say, "I'm going to call this little baby Meatloaf."
Yeah, I mean, I just love this dish so much. I've got to dedicate it to my firstborn.
Yeah, but he's you know, that. So there's something about that. Steve, I remember saying to me, it's very difficult to please everybody. So if you think about it, Jesus was killed, even though he was trying to please everybody. Gandhi was killed, even though he was trying to please everybody. And Martin Luther King was killed. So trying to please everybody is never going to work. Mm. So on certain occasions, you have to decide what it is you want. And there's a certain ruthlessness in accepting and understanding that I think probably a lot of stars have. And you might call it selfishness, or you might just say that you have to make a decision. And, you know, with that decision, you have to be true to yourself.
Yeah, 100%. That definitely seems like a recognizable trait in a lot of successful entertainers, for sure, and beyond. Final question I'm going to ask you, Henry, is what does the idea of balance mean to you or not?
I think with balance, I think you've got to realize that balance is not something you can sustain minute to minute. You know, the to's and fro's of a day, the to's and fro's of a week, the to's and fro's of a month, even the to's and fro's of a year, that you're going to have periods that are one way and periods that are another way. So you've got to think of balance in a long-term sense rather than a short-term sense. If you take my last couple of months, so I've moved house, so I've been doing lots of DIY, I know that this period is going to be, that's what I'm going to have to do in order to get the house sufficiently running that I don't have to worry about in the future. And then hopefully, because I'm touring next month, I'll do the touring, and then the month after, you know, it'll be nice and sunny, hopefully. So we might have a bit of time off and spend that as a family. So, as I say, not necessarily the balance in a day, but the balance in an overall sense. It is worth realizing that, that's what you're striving for. Some bits you have to sacrifice, and some bits you can allow yourself to enjoy yourself. There's a concept.
Yeah, wow. Give that one a go. Brilliant. All right, that's a really fantastic answer. Thank you. Where is best for people to keep up with what you're up to and see your live dates, etc.? Is it your website?
Now I don't update the website very often, but the I post almost every day on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I think Facebook is the easiest for me to post enough information to be useful and okay. for people to interact. I interact with quite a few people on Facebook, and if you post something, I always read it. I'll either put a like or I'll write a comment on okay. it. So you can message people on Facebook as well, which is quite good. Twitter's all right. I've not had any trolls so far, okay. But it is limiting with the amount of words.
Yes, yeah, especially for a poet.
Yes, well that's true. So it's usually the short ditties I put put on okay. there. Whereas if you want something more substantial, then Instagram and Facebook. I have a rule with Instagram. I only put photos on that I've taken. Anything you see on there is a photo that I've taken or someone's taken of me. I like this, like you're talking about balance. I like to change it about a bit so that all the different aspects of what you do. So it's not just about me plugging what I'm doing. If I write a poem today, if I'm going down the beach, if I write a poem today for no other reason than I've written it, I shall put it on Facebook and, you can tell me if you like it or, if you recognise anything about it.
Great. And that'll be at Henry Normal is your...
Henry Normal. I think Twitter's Henry Normal Poet.
Okay.
I think Instagram's Henry Normal Poet.
Great. Well, I'll add that all to the show notes so people can go and take a look. Henry, thank you so much for your time. It's been an absolute pleasure chatting with you. Thanks. Really appreciate it. Perfect.
Up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at hellofresh.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.